950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. FYI politics on your Friday afternoon. Brett and Eric with you. Eric, how you doing in there today?
I'm doing good. It's a beautiful May Day.
It's a beautiful May Day. By the way, we'll be talking about that a little bit later on in the show. But first, want to get right to our first guest on the show today because we have a number of topics at the state legislature and from the state capitol to talk about. We've got Kevin Featherly, the capitol reporter for Minnesota Lawyer. You can find more information at minnlawyer.com. Also follow Kevin over on Twitter at Kevin Featherly. Kevin, we got no shortage of topics to talk about today, so how you doing?
Doing good.
All right. Yeah, we were chatting before the show today, texting this morning, and there is a lot going on at the legislature and the governor's mansion and with some of the department commissioners. So, yeah, let's dive right into things. The first one I want to talk about here, Kevin, has to do with this lawsuit that the ACLU filed that has to do with prisoners not being released from prison if there is a COVID-19 outbreak, or largely not necessarily, they're saying the prisons aren't necessarily doing a good job protecting the prisoners from COVID-19. Now, as you were telling me, there was a pretty extraordinary development that just recently happened with this lawsuit. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, a judge has ruled, there's a lot of background noise, by the way. I don't know where that's coming from. I'm hearing a lot of music.
Oh, nope, I think we should have you off there. Yeah, we were trying to throw you off your game there, Kevin. Test your concentration.
A judge has ordered the department to show cause as to why it shouldn't be forced to fulfill its obligations of safety, providing a safe residence for prisoners in light of COVID-19. And that order also finds that the Department of Corrections has not done its job on that along that line, and that the inmates in the prisons do have a right to that kind of care.
Interesting. And you said this type of order that was issued by the judge is pretty rare in these types of proceedings, correct?
Well, it's a relatively rare issue. I think they've loosened things a little bit. There have been more of these. It's called a writ of mandamus, but it's a pretty extraordinary order. The courts try to avoid, exercising that authority because it's basically the court telling, in this case, would be the executive branch, how to do its job and to do it now because you're not doing it. That's something the courts really try to avoid. It's a separation of powers issue, but the writs of mandamus can be issued in extraordinary circumstances. And the judge has not issued one, but that is what's at issue here. That is what the ACLU is looking for. And, by dint of the order that she's issued, she seems to at least be considering it.
Well, continuing with what's going on with the ACLU here in Minnesota, it sounds like they also sent what we were calling a model executive order to Governor Tim Walz, talking about how we can possibly proceed with keeping prisoners that are, of course, in the prison system safe. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the ACLU sent out a model executive order. It's 8 pages long. It's relatively extraordinary what they're looking for. But it boils down to 3 basic things. They're looking for the release of people who are particularly vulnerable. So that means anybody who's 55 or older, who has COPD, cancer, heart disease, whatever it might be. So medical cases. They're also looking for, and this is new, this would be new authority, anybody who has less than a year left on their sentences, they're asking that the governor order that those folks be considered for release to home release. So we're talking about home confinement, house arrest, essentially. And then anybody who's in custody on technical violations, for having violated parole without having actually committed a new offense, they want the governor to order those folks to be released.
So in other words, yeah, we're not necessarily potentially going to be asking to have violent offenders released from prisons. These would be people, as you said, that are on technical violations or those that have less than a year on your sentence. But one interesting part you mentioned on there is that this wouldn't be a work release program. This would be house arrest, where they would be, I'm assuming, getting that ankle bracelet and have to be confined to their homes. correct?
I mean, that would be up to the governor if he were to execute an order like this.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I did get a question in through the sort of Byzantine process that we have to follow now in order to get a question asked of the governor these days. But I did get a question in, and I asked about this, but it didn't quite translate exactly as I thought, as I meant to ask the question, and he didn't answer it directly. I wanted to know if he was considering an executive order on that line. He didn't really go there. He basically said something new that I'm trying to look into. He's saying that the commissioner has begun some medical releases. If so, that's new to me. I've been in contact with the commissioner as recently as about 10 days now, and with his communications folks. I have not heard that. Doesn't mean it's not happening, but that would be something new. I know the commissioner was having some trouble, and you know, traditionally does have trouble moving folks out of the prison, felons who are, you know, for instance, end-of-life folks, they can let those out. But anybody who needs long-term care, commercial facilities are very reluctant to take them on. So, but apparently, from what the governor did say in his answer to my question, apparently there are some medical releases taking place, but I'm looking into that. I don't have any details on that yet.
And just going back to that process, talking about how you the way you now have to ask the governor's questions, because certainly you can't be in the room with the governor like you normally would be. It kind of reminds me of like one of those UN things where you need a translator to ask your questions, and sometimes things can be lost in translation. So it's certainly a different process, I'm guessing, for you and other folks in the media when they're trying to ask the governor questions.
I will not pretend it's not slightly frustrating. I mean, mm-hmm. when in those press conferences, I typically get my question asked, and the governor's willing to answer these questions. Mm-hmm. That's not the point. But what is happening is that because of COVID-19 and because he's no longer under personal lockdown, he is going out in public, but they want to keep as few people in the room as possible. So they're having three pool reporters, but they arrived at a solution who to include in the pool based on, as I understand it, whoever is considered a permanent member of the Capitol Press Corps, which apparently I don't qualify, even though I'm there every day and it's my full-time job. I guess because I don't actually rent space in the Capitol. So somebody called that a pay-as-you-play arrangement. I will not argue.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I did get a question in, and there are ways. It's a workaround, but this is the first time after several tries that's actually worked out for me.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like a messy situation. I'm sure they're trying to work their way through trying to get questions answered. But as you said, there's certainly some improvements that look like they could be made to the entire process, because it is important to make sure we are getting our elected officials to answer questions. I mean, you certainly don't want to have them use this as an excuse not to answer questions, not saying that's happening now, but it's still important to make sure we have the ability to have the press ask questions of our elected officials.
And I'm actually glad you put it that way, because I do think they're trying as best they can to make this work for everybody. The thing about these remote press conferences is that, as I understand it, there are many, many more people trying to get involved than the 36 people that might show up at a press conference. Now you're having hundreds of people trying to call in, because all those folks in the outstate area, I used to do this. I was a Capitol reporter in quotation marks when I worked in Waseca, but I never went to the Capitol because there was no budget at the newspaper to send me there. So I was covering it by phone. So all of the folks that are in that position in newspapers in greater Minnesota, that's what they're now. They have an opportunity to talk to the governor. So I don't blame them for wanting to get involved.
I don't know if you know the answer to this question. I just find this kind of interesting. Like, when we know a big announcement is coming at one of Governor Walz' press conferences, like yesterday when he was giving an update on the stay-at-home order, are there usually more reporters that are calling in and therefore making it a little bit tougher to get questions in, or aren't you even in a position to even know the answer to that?
I can only surmise that that's exactly right.
Yeah, I would guess that would probably be the case, too. All right, let's get back into some policy that's been happening over there at the Capitol. So I want to ask you about this, Kevin, because I heard maybe at the legislature, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that we were possibly looking at expanding the authority of the Commissioner of Corrections, that would be Paul Schnell, allowing him to have a little bit more power in terms of possibly releasing prisoners early from prison. Did I kind of summarize that right, or can you correct me on that? Kind of talk about that a little bit.
You're not wrong. I certainly had been pressing the governor back in the old days when I used to be able to ask him questions on a frequent basis. Mm-hmm. I was pressing him pretty hard on that. Are you considering an executive order? Because at one point he said he was. there was talk about, and this is actually live again because it's in legislation, but there was talk about a month and a half ago of having the legislature grant him power to release people on work release when they had 180 days left on their sentences. And that is now, again, in live legislation that was just passed through public safety, or excuse me, public safety yesterday. What the commissioner told me in a conversation that's been about 10 days ago is that because that fell through and it wasn't live for a time, he was really looking at just the authority that he has and executing on that. And he has begun releasing prisoners. I think as of today, there should be somewhere between 26 and 28 prisoners who have been released early to work release settings. I don't know if there's any more than that, but that's what, as of Friday, that was the number that they were expecting would happen. It could go up, it could go down, so I'm not really sure the precise number, but that's what I had been told as of today should happen. The commissioner did, as I talked last week, I don't know if I zeroed in on it and described it quite as well as I could have, but what the commissioner has told me is that within statute, he does have authority to release people to work release on a supervised basis once they have reached the halfway mark in their sentences. Again, I don't think that's something he's going to do. And I can tell you that Senator Limmer, the House Judiciary, or excuse me, Senate Judiciary Chair, who knows the statute, that part of the statute book, as well as anybody in existence, said he did not know that that authority existed.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, and as you said, yeah, unlikely he would exercise that type of authority of releasing people with half their sentence left. But in theory,
it would be both a politically unpalatable and a correctionally in probably incorrect move. Then that's what the commissioner said. That wouldn't be a correctionally sound move to make, partly because you'd have to figure out how to keep these folks on supervised work release for, you know, if it's a guy who's been sentenced to 6 years, has served three, now you're going to keep him on work release for 3 years?
Yeah, that sounds definitely unrealistic, and we certainly did touch on that last week. Hey, we're speaking with Kevin Featherly. He is the Capitol reporter for Minnesota Lawyer. A couple more topics at the legislature I want to talk to you about, Kevin, and this one actually came today, I believe, out of the House Ways and Means Committee that has to do with unallotment, because if we go back to the days of Governor Tim Pawlenty, we remember him exercising unallotment quite a bit, where he could basically take certain amounts of money away from budgets that have already been passed. And of course, being that we have an emergency situation now with COVID-19, in theory, Governor Tim Walz could do this same thing. And what happened today, I believe, in the House Ways and Means Committee is that they're asking for a presentation from the Minnesota Management and Budget Office to talk about what sorts of authority Governor Walz has on this in terms of whether the legislature is in or out of session, which is really important to point out. Can you talk more about this, Kevin?
Yeah, that was just in passing at the end. This was after the Ways and Means Committee had passed a really large $100+ million bill that has housing elements. It's actually a $170 million bill that has broadband, small business loans, personal care assistance, temporary pay increases. After that was passed, just in passing, Representative Pawlowski asked the committee chair, Representative Carlson, can we have a presentation by MMB next Wednesday on the governor's unallotment authority? I presume that's going to happen. The chair said he thought that was a good idea and that he would give a heads up to MMB on that. So I presume that is going to happen.
Interesting.
So
okay.
I think what you're asking about, I don't remember if you asked, but the question of unallotment authority is kind of a question mark. Mm-hmm. Because as you know, Governor Pawlenty did do quite a bit of that for a number of years. And it wasn't really questioned. Even all the way up to, I think, 2009, there was a lawsuit challenged in Ramsey County Court, and it was dismissed. Judge Guerin dismissed it, and that was an unallotment plan. But there was an appeal, and then a second lawsuit was filed. And in that second case, Judge Guerin actually granted, you know, the suit, and she ruled that the governor had exceeded his authority in 2009 with his unallotment plan, I think largely because he was trying to get rid of general assistance medical care, and she felt that that was going too far. Then the legislature did its own compromise, got the, you know, medical assistance back in place, and so the lawsuit sort of fizzled. But that leaves the question of just where is that authority? Now, Governor Quay back in the day did quite a bit of unallotments for a couple of years running, and so did, as we noted, Governor Plenty. So that authority has been used, and it was unchallenged for much of the time that it was in use. Where that authority lies now, I think, is a big question mark, and it'll be interesting to hear that presentation to see what MMB thinks the governor's authority is right now.
Yeah, and just one more time to refresh everyone's memory on this, essentially unallotment, and as we talked about, this happened several times during the Tim Pawlenty administration, and it was certainly very controversial, being that at that time we had, I believe, both a DFL House and a DFL Senate, but a Republican governor. Basically, as I understand it, under unallotment, when you have a budget that's already been passed and signed into law, the governor can go in and take away funding of some of these budget lines, if I'm reading it correctly, under different scenarios to try to close budget gaps, correct?
Exactly. When you wind up, you know, after you've passed a budget and then suddenly you wind up in a giant deficit, what are you going to do? And mm-hmm. so, yeah, that's what he was doing. He was actually taking money away from people, from agencies that had already had that money passed and appropriated.
So talking about one of these concerns that we had from some of the House members, they were talking about whether Governor Walz could use unallotment if the legislature was in or out of session. Can you talk about why that's important, making that distinction between whether they're in or out of session? I'm assuming they're making the argument that he can only do it when they're in session, or maybe they just have that question in general.
I think I don't know the answer to the question of what they're thinking is that was only done in passing, but I can only imagine that their reason for wanting to know that is because if they're out of session, they can't override him with a veto.
Yeah,
and
that would
be. If they're in session, mm-hmm. they can.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, because you're right. Yeah, in theory, yeah, you could have the legislature override, yeah, what the governor would possibly do with unallotment. And, yeah, certainly does bring back memories of the final years of the Tim Pawlenty administration when that was certainly in the news.
Right.
One more topic to talk about with you here, Kevin. And this one I find interesting that's taking place in the legislature right now. It's actually in the House, but as a heads up, this bill, as we chatted about earlier, probably doesn't have any chance of going through the Senate. But there's some really notable provisions in this House bill that has to do with what's called civil forfeiture, which basically means, like, for instance, if you get convicted of a DWI, you potentially could have your car seized by the government. And then the government, as I understand, could possibly sell some of those types of things they seize from you at a profit. So we had a pretty large bill, it looks like, Kevin, that was passed through a House committee. And as you talked about, probably won't go through the Senate. But can you talk about some of these provisions that are in this House bill?
Yeah, just to let you know where it stands, it's gone through two committees and it passed. It's going to a third, and it's a big compromise. Mm-hmm. And I'll get back to that. But what to answer your question directly, and we'll get back to, you know, what this represents. It alters DWI forfeitures so that it puts a focus on repeat offenders and people who have, you know, for instance, three DWIs mm-hmm. in 10 years or who have committed a felony DWI offense. It really targets those folks and doesn't target, you know, basically just somebody who's maybe got their first or second DWI. And so that's one policy change. It also offers more protections to what they call innocent owners, because there was a case, it was called Olson v. 1999 Lexus, in which the owner had to sue her car. That's literally what that means, to get her car back. And the Supreme Court ruled that this was an innocent owner who was put through much, much too much rigmarole in her attempt to get her car back. And they found that was, you know, that was illegal. It also does some things like sets a threshold at $1,500 for the amount of money and property seized. Now, this isn't just about cars. This is also about cash. So if you've got a drug deal and the cops bust in and they find there's $1,500 in the house, they may have to leave that alone. They've been just able to take as much money as they can find at a drug scene. This may be an exaggeration, but I think there have been cases where literally, you know, like they've busted piggy banks open, okay? So stuff like that. they can't do that anymore. And this was something that Jeff Potts, the Bloomington police chief, really didn't like. He didn't like this $1,500 threshold. He didn't want to have a limit on the, you know, a cap or, you know, a threshold, a floor as to how much money they can take. They can, if it's $1,501, they can take it. And if, and they can take some of that money if it's under that, if they can show that it's directly related to certain crimes. But otherwise, you know, it's not just, you know, take whatever you can and just, you know, use it. It has some reporting requirements for forfeited property so that we're going to, you know how much property is being taken, what the cash is being used for. That's stuff the legislature wants to know. There are some other things along that line. This is a big compromise because this has been something that has been a perennial topic, you know, civil forfeitures. They've been trying to get, you know, there have been forces in the legislature trying to really do away with this because they feel it's a horrible conflict of interest for law enforcement to be making busts and then profiting from them. However, the law enforcement, probably quite rightly, will come back and say, well, look, we need this money because we're not being, our budgets aren't being fulfilled. We're making requests. You're not giving us the money we need. We need it to come from somewhere. We have to do these things. And they also make the argument that these forfeitures for, particularly for like repeat DWI offenses, it's the only way to make somebody stop. You take their car. It's the only way to get them off the highway. So, I mean, there's arguments on both sides, but this is a compromise. What it doesn't include, the big ticket items it doesn't include, is it doesn't get rid of administrative forfeitures, which means that if a car is seized in a DWI case, and if the guy who had it stolen, or excuse, forgive me, it's not stolen, it's seized, who had it seized, fails to contest that forfeiture, they get to keep it. There has, unless that is contested formally, then the administrative forfeiture goes ahead. The other thing that the opponent, that the proponents of the more sort of fulsome reform wanted was to combine civil forfeiture with criminal forfeitures, because right now it's two processes. If you're being charged with a crime, you know, let's say it's DWI, let's say it's a drug offense, if you're being charged with a crime and you've had your property seized, that forfeiture isn't part of the criminal case. It's an entirely separate thing where you have to sue. You have to file a civil suit to make that happen. And that's been a problem for like the public defenders because they can't, they don't have the resources to represent a guy in two different proceedings. They're strapped. They have hundreds of clients. They can't possibly represent a guy in two different proceedings. So the guy's on his own in the civil proceeding as things stand. But that system is going to continue. That compromise does not eliminate that bifurcated process. And so that's why one of the reasons Senator Limmer, the Senate author of that bill, doesn't like this compromise and will not go along with it. And that is why the bill is almost certainly not going to go anywhere.
Well, that's
despite the fact that it was an 18-0 vote in judiciary, including all of the Republicans and including some of the DFLers who had opposed this previously.
Well, that's quite a dynamic you're bringing up right there, because so often the narrative we get is that it's the Republicans who want to be tough on crime, and it's Democrats who are often accused of not being tough enough on crime. But as you're talking about right here, Senator Warren Limmer, who, by the way, is a Republican, is not
Newman,
in favor.
Newman,
who's not in favor of this bill because, yeah, it doesn't go and help with that provision, which, as you're talking about, if you have your property seized, for instance, if you get a DWI, trying to get that property back is a separate civil lawsuit. It's not part of the criminal proceedings, which is important because, as you brought up, you generally don't get a public defender, for instance, if you're trying to win a case that's, well, a civil lawsuit. So that's important, and that's interesting that he's one of the people that's very much in favor of changing that process and making it easier for defendants in these types of cases. And that's one of the reasons why he doesn't like this bill, is because it wasn't included in this compromise.
But it makes some sense when you think about it, because the people on the liberal side who are for criminal justice reform really do have common interests with the civil libertarians who want government to have limited power as it comes particularly to seizing of property and seizing of the, you know, the person's body and putting them in prison.
Well, yeah, it's Yeah, it's really interesting to kind of think about this case and, yeah, think about this bill and where everyone stands on it because, yeah, it doesn't necessarily fall along traditional Democratic or Republican lines. But I guess if you think about it in a deeper sense, like you say, it kind of does make sense. So
this is why President Trump was able to support criminal justice reform with the First Step Act.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, that's kind of right with this. So are we expecting maybe – so this probably won't go through the Senate as we talked about. Are they possibly looking at tabling this towards next year? Any thoughts on what could happen next?
I think that what Newman's strategy here is to keep the pressure on. So, yes, I absolutely think he's going to want to revisit this. I think he's going to want to revisit this and try to pressure law enforcement to accept more. I don't know how successful he'll be there, though, because what happened here, the process involved 14 different constituency groups who met for months and months and even had a quasi-mediation session involving a retired judge to help them hammer out the differences. I mean, this was a real process that went on for months and months that wound up with a compromise solution that the ACLU could support, Minnesota Legal Services, the County Attorneys Association, the Sheriff's Association, but I'm told today that they peeled off and no longer supported. Senator Limmer, this time it is actually Senator Limmer we're talking about, told me that this morning.
Well, that's Kevin Featherly. He is the Capitol reporter from Minnesota Lawyer. You can find more information at minlawyer.com. Also, make sure you follow Kevin on Twitter at Kevin Featherly. Yeah, this is a bill that kind of gets into the weeds, but it's something I'm certainly going to continue to follow because there's a lot of things in here that I would support, including the fact that they're talking about, yeah, if you do end up facing a DWI case, if you have your property seized, you should be able to combine that, I think, with your criminal case to try to contest and get your property back rather than having that go through a civil case, which is much tougher to do, being that you don't get representation from a public defender. That's at least me, though, but yeah, we'll have to watch.
Well, you have now made common cause with the libertarians.
We have made common cause with the libertarians. Who would have thought? Kevin, really appreciate the time today.
Thank you.
All right, again, you can follow Kevin over on Twitter at Kevin Featherly. We'll take a break here on FYI Politics. Come on back with some local news coming up next.
During this stay-at-home time, many of us are getting around to what needs doing at home. So how is your vacuum cleaner running? Is it time to get it repaired or maybe even replaced? Great news! A1 Vacuum in Roseville is open for curbside service. We're here from 10 until 2, Monday through Saturday. Give us a call at 651-222-6316 to place your order for curbside supplies, repairs, or replacements. Find more information and updates at a-1vacuum.com.
Even though these are challenging times, All Energy Solar is still committed to providing you a cost-effective, environmentally friendly energy system through their zero-contact protocol. Solar remains a great value and long-term investment, but some of the incentive programs will be expiring soon. All Energy Solar can walk you through the entire process. They can evaluate your property by phone or webinar and can even complete preliminary design work without visiting your home. So start saving on your energy bill today and visit allenergysolar.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Paul Mensa, host of the Wall and Power Radio Hour, telling you about a great event this Sunday night at 6 p.m. on AM 950. Paul Mensa and Sonny Earl, we've been playing together since 1997, are doing a live show being broadcast on AM 950. We're going to be playing my original tune, some blues, a little country, and who knows what else. We might even tell some jokes. Live, Paul Mensa and Sonny Earl, 6 to 7 p.m. Sunday night on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Hi, everyone. Matt McNeil here to say thanks for keeping your radio tuned to AM 950 during this crisis. I also wanted to thank everyone from the bottom of my heart who's become a member of AM 950 over the last few weeks. It's so important to keep AM 950 on the air, maintaining a progressive radio voice in Minnesota for 2020. We feature the best in progressive talk and great local hosts like Brett Johnson, Robert Pilot, and myself. We started our membership program to make sure AM 950 got through this trying time, and you, the listener, have responded. Thank you so very much. You can become a member by simply heading over to am950radio.com and donating. The membership response has been so great. We're planning on launching some brand new members-only content, starting with some great new interviews. Tom Hartman will have a regular monthly members-only interview, and we'll have new member content updated weekly. Head over to am950radio.com and declare, yes, I want to support AM950. For everyone who is a member, thank you so very much for your support, and thanks for listening to the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, AM 950.
Minuteman Press Uptown is the only minority-owned union print shop in the state, and they truly believe that a rising tide lifts all ships. Minuteman Press has created the Bounce Back USA campaign to help the community and local economy through the pandemic. Bounce Back USA is a free platform from Minuteman Press that serves two purposes, safety and stimulus. With safety first, they're distributing COVID-19 awareness and prevention posters at no charge to any business in their service area. Minuteman Press Uptown is also providing free local advertising on BounceBackUSA.com to stimulate business and help all of our neighbors. So post your company message to stimulate your own economy on their totally free marketing platform at BounceBackUSA.com. You can design your own ad or just type the message and upload your logo. Minuteman Press Uptown's experts with 100-plus years of industry experience will take it from there. That's Minuteman Press Uptown, still open and printing everything, and committed to helping the local economy through BounceBackUSA.com.
With your AM 950 weather, this is Eric Nelson. Today, a 40% chance of rain after 10 a.m. with a high of 67. Tonight, partly cloudy skies with a low around 53. Saturday, mostly sunny with a high of 73 and a low 49, while Sunday will be sunny with a high of 72 and a low around 46. AM 950 wants to say thank you to all the listeners that have supported us by becoming members. We are committed to getting through this and to supporting our community, but we can still use help through membership as we are a long way from getting through this virus. If you'd like to support AM 950 by becoming a member, go to am950radio.com.
Hey, we got Robert Pilot checking in on our Facebook stream. Of course, the host of many programs from Native Roots Radio on AM 950, including I'm Awake, Saturdays from 1 until 3, Pilot's Progressive Party every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m., and then the brand new show, Native Roots Radio Presents We're Still Here, which you can catch Sundays from 10 until midnight, checked in on the Facebook stream and said, Happy Minnesota Native American Indian Month. Hey, by the way, Robert Pilot just put out a really cool video out there on the Native Roots Radio Facebook page. It has to do with the fact that, well, Native Roots Radio has launched a Patreon account, being that they've unfortunately not lost a number of advertisers with what's happening with the COVID-19 pandemic. But it's a nice animated video, really nice animation job done over there by Robert Pilot. You can check that out over on the AM 950 Radio Facebook page over or also on the Native Roots Radio Facebook page. Go check it out and give them a donation if you can as well on their Native Roots Radio Patreon account. So going back to what we were talking about with Kevin, I get where the police departments are coming from saying, well, if we can't seize money and profit off of it, well, then we could potentially be facing some budget shortfalls. But if that's really the way that police departments are solving any budget shortfalls is from seizing property from their constituents, that's a problem outside of their constituents. That's a problem with the state legislature or the local city not giving them enough money.
Exactly. And if the main way they fund themselves is to steal money, I don't really want them to have money because it makes them more efficient at stealing stuff from us.
What could possibly go wrong with that type of policy where you incentivize the police to steal money from you? Well, not necessarily steal. Well, people can think of it in that way. I'll use the more legal term, seize money, although some folks would use the word steal money. But it goes back to the old adage we sometimes hear with traffic cops, how, well, in essence, they have to meet their traffic quotas and issue a number of traffic tickets to make sure they're funding the police department. It largely goes to the same idea that we were talking about with Kevin, where, some police departments could face some major budget shortfalls if, in this potential House bill, they are limited to only $1,500 in seizures, at least most seizures. As he talked about, there would be some exceptions where if the money seized specifically has to do with a crime, then they could seize more than $1,500 worth of assets. But at least in that House bill, it would put that limit at $1,500. But that won't be enacted this year, as Kevin talked about. Very unlikely that that bill would make its way through the Senate, but if you're a police department and you're getting a large part of your funding from seizing assets of criminals, that's not a problem that you should be having with your constituents. That's a problem you need to be taking up with City Hall or the state legislature to make sure you're getting the proper amount of funding. That's a government-level issue, not something that you should be trying to use to seize money from people who live within your city's borders or within the police department's borders. We're at 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. And just one other thing I wanted to emphasize again. Yeah, I largely agree with that provision in the bill where if you are convicted of a crime and specifically, let's say, a DWI, and you end up getting your car seized, you have an entirely different procedure in trying to get your car back, because if you're appealing the DWI conviction, that's a criminal case, and you can get the representation of a public defender. But to get your car back, that's a civil trial, which is an entirely different legal proceeding. And for the most part, you're not going to get the help of a public defender in a civic proceeding, which means if you're someone who doesn't make a lot of money, you're pretty much out of luck when you're trying to get your car or other property back. So
yeah, trying to navigate any of those sort of bureaucracies, especially ones where they don't have any sort of help in place, it's, you know, it's, what's the word, Kafka-esque?
Yeah.
Where you have no clue to even where to begin looking for help.
And I just like that dynamic, too, that it turns out it's Republican Senator Scott Newman who wanted that provision included in the bill to give some folks help with that, and it was not included in the House compromise bill, and that's largely why Senator Newman says it won't be making its way through the Senate, but they might end up revisiting that next year. Hey, let's talk to Randy in St. Cloud, who wants to chime in on police accountability. Hey, Randy, what are you thinking about today?
Well, in what you've been talking about, and civil forfeiture is the biggest scam in the world. I mean, not every piece of it is, but there is a lot of that. And there's a huge legal situation happening in Baltimore where they found a drug task force was stealing all kinds of money, falsifying all kinds of records, selling the drugs they were seizing, all this stuff. Anyway, but one of the things that, in looking into that story, one of the things that was made clear to me is that when we have police misconduct, police brutality charges, and people file against the police department and the city or the state, the taxpayers end up paying the fines that get levied in that. And one of the things that was brought up in the story I was watching on the Baltimore situation is, how about if we had the police, they have a defined benefit package, unlike a 401k. They have the old-style real pension. When they retire, they get their pension money every month for the rest of their lives, which I'm fine with that. But if, and it's a huge amount of money anyway, if we were to take the fine out of the police defined benefit fund, the police would do a whole lot to clean up their crap all on their own. Nobody would have to say a thing, because if there was a $2 million settlement for beating the crap out of somebody that was innocent, the citizens of the city wouldn't pay for it. The police in retirement fund would pay for it, and believe me, the police would address that really, really, really quickly.
Well, thanks for the call there, Randy, and good job not to have a little slip up of the tongue right there when we were talking about beating the something out of their out of folks. But it's a draconian proposal that Randy makes, but no matter what you think about it, he's not wrong that it would probably work immediately, because that would incentivize, obviously, not the so-called, not just the so-called bad cops from, well, beating people up, as he says, but it would certainly incentivize the so-called good cops from encouraging, well, the bad cops not to beat people up. I mean, it's a very draconian measure, but it probably would have some success. I'm not sure
One of the biggest issues is just that the cops look out for each other. It's hard, very hard for us to police the police.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like a very draconian type of thing that Randy's proposing, but yeah, he's not wrong that it would probably end up working, as he says, almost immediately. Other news today, of course, today is May Day, or International Workers' Day, and there's lots of events taking place, not just in Minnesota, but around the entire country. I know on this May Day, we have workers from places like Amazon, Instacart, Whole Foods, Walmart, Target, and FedEx that are calling out sick and walking out during their lunch breaks to demand better health and safety conditions, along with hazard pay, which, by the way, if you work in like an Amazon or a facility like that where you have a high risk of potentially contracting COVID-19, you probably should be getting hazard pay. Others are joining them for May Day actions that include rent strikes, car caravan protests, and online organizing for a people's bailout and economic recovery plan that, of course, prioritizes workers. That comes to us from Democracy Now, talking about some of those actions that are going to be taking place. We also have an International Workers Day event that's going to be taking place on the AM 950 airwaves tonight, by the way. We have a special broadcast this evening at 7 o'clock. Yes, we are preempting the broadcast, but I think this is going to be something you're going to enjoy listening to. Take Action Minnesota is going to be having a quarantine concert. It's going to be highlighting International Workers Day, the struggles workers face, also telling you a little bit more about Take Action Minnesota, and having some great music from Jeremy Messersmith, who is a very talented artist. That's going to be tonight from 7 until 8 o'clock on AM 950, Take Action Minnesota's quarantine concert in celebration of International Workers Day, or I guess celebration is maybe not the right word, recognition of International Workers Day. So make sure you tune into that special broadcast this evening from 7 until 8 o'clock. Take one more call before we head to our next break. Let's go to Pat in St. Paul, who wants to chime in on civil forfeiture. Pat, what are you thinking about today?
Well, the last caller talked about taking money out of defined benefit pensions. People need to understand that, I've worked for a large metropolitan county for 34 years, okay, and I contribute to my pension, and the county matches mm-hmm. that contribution. And then when I reach a retirement age, my benefits are paid for by the interest that comes off those mm-hmm. those contributions over the time of my employment. And I don't see how, you know, you'd actually be punishing everybody for the actions of a few people.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It certainly would be a very draconian type of measure if you were to do that. I think there's better solutions to potentially deal with that.
I'm not going to argue that it's not like that, but in the same way, we're punishing everyone when we make all the taxpayers pay for these.
Right. If people are stealing from civil forfeiture, that's a felony. Anytime you steal anything from the government, that's a felony, and those people should be fired. As far as, you know, police brutality or whatever, I think we need to really rethink how we train law enforcement mm-hmm. from the very beginning.
I mean, there are
a lot of mentally ill people that get killed. You know, I have two sons on the autistic spectrum. I shudder to think what would happen if they had a confrontation with the police and the police didn't know what their situation was. So, I mean, you know, I don't think there's a lot of ill will, but the law, the standard that says a police officer can take your life if they're afraid of you, that's a broad thing, and I think that we really need to look at that at some point and retrain our police officers. To punish all police officers for the actions of a few, I think, is a bad idea. And I'm not a police officer, just so you know.
Yeah, okay? I get where you're coming from, Pat, and I think Randy's point was more that, at least this is my point more, is that what we're doing right now is clearly not working when it comes to police brutality. That would certainly be a drastic measure to take. There's certainly some better things you could do, including what our last caller was talking about, having better training for the police officers. I think another step would be when we have a case where a police officer murders someone, if we're going back and remembering what happened like in 2014, 15, or 16, the entire grand jury process needs to be reformed. Just to refresh your memory on this, when a police officer kills someone, usually the case gets brought before a grand jury. Now, in legal proceedings, pretty much any attorney can get the grand jury to make the case move ahead to the full jury system, if that kind of makes any sense. They can indict pretty much anyone they want because there's no defense opposition. And usually in grand jury cases, like 99% of the time, there's an indictment. Basically, the only times where a grand jury does not indict someone is usually when the case has to do with a police officer. And I think that largely has to do with the fact that, well, you're talking about a county attorney that directly works with the police on other cases, which is problematic.
Yeah, is the prosecutor going to want to go after this guy?
I think the better solution would be you need an independent prosecutor that comes from outside the county, because your county prosecutor has incentive to work with the police, and that's generally why when you look at grand jury cases, those are the only times you have a grand jury case that does not result in an indictment. So there's certainly lots of other solutions you can make when it comes to solving police misconduct and police brutality and those sorts of things. Again, Randy's solution was a little bit more on the drastic side, but you know,
yeah.
If we're not going to take any other actions whatsoever, I mean,
yeah,
maybe
I don't
you do need to go with something like that. Just
I don't agree with like the extent that like Randy was speaking about, but mm-hmm. maybe something along those lines where mm-hmm. the funds, it somehow penalizes the police department rather than all the taxpayers.
And you do make a fair point right there because, yeah, when you get those fines levied against police departments, that's the taxpayers that end up footing that bill. It just doesn't go to one police department or one city. That goes to the entire taxpaying base. So either way, you end up paying for it. So, yeah, maybe if you make that type of proposal, not in all seriousness, but just to kind of shed light on how serious the situation is, maybe you could end up getting some change to the entire process. Either way, it certainly isn't working now. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Come on back for one final segment of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
If you have a painting project, you should consider hiring Nick Slavic Painting and Restoration Company. We've been awarded nationally for craftsmanship, are highly professional, responsive, and fairly priced. If you feel overwhelmed by starting a painting project, we make it easy from start to finish. We move furniture, vacuum, sweep, dust, and put your home back the way we found it. There is a difference. Our professionalism sets us apart. Visit NICKSLAVIK.com. That's NickSlavic.com to learn more.
Finding the right lawyer is incredibly stressful. It can be tough to know even where to start. Don't just run an internet search for an attorney. Start with the Minnesota Lawyer Referral and Information Service, an enhanced program of the Hennepin and Ramsey County Bar Associations. They'll connect you with over 200 thoroughly vetted, qualified attorneys practicing in over 50 areas of law. Call 612-752-6699 or go to mnlawyerreferral.org. The right call for the right lawyer.
In the Army National Guard, family means everything.
They really appreciate what she's done as a sister as well as a soldier and, you know, supporting their country.
Our parents, they were really supportive that all five of us would join.
Family members that are soldiers in the Army National Guard inspire and influence, setting a path for others.
It's validating knowing that, you know, I kind of did my part to make sure this is what they actually wanted and that they feel the same way I do. I'm really proud that we get to help shape the future, and I know that my sisters are going to be amazing soldiers.
Serving part-time in the Army National Guard instills pride that you and your family will share in.
A lot of pride, and they're just out there doing something every day and then serving their country as well.
I got my education because of the Guard. I got to travel a little bit and experience a whole different culture.
Visit NationalGuard.com to learn more about part-time service. Sponsored by the Minnesota Army National Guard. Aired by the Minnesota Broadcasters Association and this station.
Hi, this is Ken Hagland, host of Living Healthy and Aging Well, inviting you to listen to our new show airing on Saturdays from noon to 1, where we talk about your health and your life and provide insights to living and aging well. Each week, we provide answers to important questions regarding health care, elder care, end-of-life care, and caregiver support to help you and your loved ones plan for the future and enjoy your highest quality of life today. Please join us every Saturday from noon to 1 for Living Healthy and Aging Well.
Hey, it's Brett from FYI Politics. We appreciate you listening to AM 950 and promoting Minnesota's only progressive talk station. We also want to remind you how important it is to support our advertisers amid the coronavirus outbreak. The advertisements you hear on AM 950 are what allows us to stay on the airwaves and bring you the best in progressive talk radio. We're not funded through some giant parent company. We're an independent, locally owned business that relies on the local advertisers you hear. Unfortunately, many of those advertisers are going to be hit hard by the coronavirus closures. So please, support our advertisers in any way that you can. Whether that's ordering some delicious takeout food from one of our Eat Local Minnesota restaurants, purchasing gift cards, or even just contacting them and telling them thanks for supporting AM 950. We know times are tough, so even the littlest thing you can do can go a long way to help. Find a full list of our advertisers at am950radio.com. That's am950radio.com. And thanks for listening.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Final segment of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Let's run the phone lines for these last few minutes and talk to Rick in St. Louis Park. Rick, got about 1 minute for you. What's on your mind?
Well, if the police were to self-insure themselves with their own personal money, and an insurance company didn't like what they were doing, mm-hmm. they'd cut them loose, and the cop would have to probably quit or might get fired.
Yeah, that's largely how insurance works. I don't think that's a bad idea at all there, Rick, so do appreciate the phone call at 952-946-6205. Have time for maybe one or two more phone calls. Let's get Lawrence in St. Paul in on the conversation. Hey there, Lawrence.
No, I think Randy had a good point. Drastic measures are required mm-hmm. for unsustainable situations.
Yeah, I mean, now, if we're not going to do anything else, I mean, maybe you need to go to those drastic measures.
Yeah, because tell that to the black mother that just lost her black son for no reason other than the cop was afraid. Tell that to Philando Castile's children when they grow up. And your last caller, tell that to him when the cop shoots his autistic kids, because the cop is improperly trained, improperly ready for that position. He will be vetted out if you use Randy's methods, because I tell you why, because pressure. See, here's how things work psychologically. That's you, me, everybody. We take pride because of a group, and we take pride because we're in a group. Those are the two things that make us work successfully at work. If you penalize the entire group, that person will be weeded out by other persons mm-hmm. in the group. And I'll listen to your comments.
Yeah, that goes back to some of those. I remember doing this back in grade school when you had those types of punishments from the teacher where if one student acted up, you would, for instance, have the entire pizza party canceled. I think that happened to me back in grade school.
Yeah, or they'll say something like, well, if the person who's guilty doesn't come forward and say who it is,
we
penalize everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone knows who did it, so the mm-hmm. person comes forward because, yeah, I don't want to be responsible for this.
Yeah, to have that type of group responsibility could be a step in the right direction. And just to, you know, I think would be not be a bad solution to this whole idea, because I would get the argument that people would be saying you're putting an undue burden on police officers, not saying whether I agree with that or not, to face all of that extra training. Well, how about this? Fine, let's increase that amount of training they get to make sure we have actual peaceful interactions with the police. I would be fine with giving the police raises and giving them more money if we were to have increased standards, have that trade-off right there.
Yeah, when they talk about police funding, it's never about increasing, you know, your ability
exactly.
to just, mm-hmm. Resolve situations without violent conflict.
I would be fully in favor of that. Yeah, if we're going to increase the amount of training that police need, yeah, fine. Then increase their funding as well and make sure you're only getting people who are properly trained to be police officers. All right, that's all the time I got for today. We got Matt McNeil coming up next.